something that we want to really speak about. That's that kind of thing we want to like push under the carpet. We want to kind of like say, okay, that doesn't happen so much. And frankly, even if you look at the various Mefarshim in Tanakh, there's a little bit of a split among the Mefarshim. There are those who say, well, you know, the Avos, for instance, they never sinned, right? And let's make sure that we shine them up as best as possible. And even when we have a question, we wouldn't want them to look bad in our eyes. And very frankly, it's not just true of the Mefarshim or of an approach to what role models look like, but this is actually true in many, many places, right? If somebody writes a biography of somebody, right? And it could be a president of the United States, and it could be Lahavdil, a Gadol Hador. Very often there's an effort to suggest the stories of their life and show them in the best possible way. We certainly live in a world and a generation where you don't have to be a Gadol, you don't have to be a president, but even when we post things about ourselves and our lives, what are the things that we choose to post? We choose to post the things that are our best and brightest moments, right? So it could be the picture that we think projects us in the best possible way or the accomplishments. Even when we write a resume, okay, there was a famous suggestion made a number of years ago in a New York Times op-ed article that instead of just writing a resume of all of our successes, right, so you're putting together a list of things that you want included in a letter of recommendation or you're applying for a job, we generally, what do we put in a resume? All of the things which are our successes, right? And there was a suggestion, which maybe I'll come back to at the end to discuss a little bit, that perhaps we should be making resumes of our failures. Perhaps we should be making a resume of all of the things that we attempted to do and we weren't necessarily successful in. Now, what any of this has to do with Emuna, I think will become clear by the time we're finished. But I actually wanted to start with a video I don't think most of you have seen. You'll tell me afterwards if you have. The moms in the rooms are going to have a deep appreciation for. And I think even our SK students will appreciate as well. If you could just have me hit the light. But what I want you to do while you're watching this two-minute video is just to try to think to yourself what the relationship between failure, what is the attitude, I should say, towards failure in this particular clip?
According to today's regulators and bureaucrats, those of us who were kids in the 50s, 60s, 70s, or even early 80s probably should not have survived. Our baby cribs were covered with bright-colored lead-based paint. We had no childproof lids or locks on medicine bottles, doors, or cabinets. And when we rode our bikes, we had no helmets. We drank water from the garden hose and not from a bottle. We ate cupcakes, bread, and butter, and drank soda with lots of sugar in it. But we were rarely overweight because we were always outside playing. We would leave home in the morning and play all day, as long as we were back when the streetlights came on. No one was able to reach us all day. Smartphones? We didn't have cell phones at all. No PlayStations, Xboxes, limitless channels on cable, laptops or tablets. Facebook was an actual face and an actual book. We had friends. We went outside and found them. We played dodgeball, and sometimes the ball would hurt. We fell out of trees, got cut, and broke bones and teeth. And there were no lawsuits from these accidents. No one was to blame but us. Remember accidents? We had fights and punched each other. We got black and blue and learned to get over it. We made up games with sticks and tennis balls. And although we were told it would happen, we didn't put out any eyes. We rode bikes or walked to a friend's home, knocked on the door, rang the bell, or just walked right in and talked to him. Little League had tryouts, and not everyone made the team. Those who didn't had to learn to deal with disappointment. Some students weren't as smart as others, so they failed a grade and were held back to repeat the same grade. Tests were not adjusted for any reason. Our actions were our own. Consequences were expected. The idea of parents bailing us out if we got in trouble at school or broke a law was unheard of. They actually sided with the school or the law. Imagine that. Now, this generation has produced some of the best risk takers, problem solvers, and inventors ever. We had freedom, failure, success, and responsibility, and we learned how to deal with it. If you've related to anything that was just said, you're one of them. Congratulations. You made it.
Okay, Tab, you just hit the light for a second. Okay, so the video is obviously contrasting the era that I grew up in, that many of our moms grew up in, with the current world that many of you are growing up in. And I think it's definitely a little slanted towards one side of the conversation, but it presents a little bit of a dialectic. It presents two sides of an issue. I don't think the point in the video is to suggest that we shouldn't have safety caps on medicine bottles, or that we shouldn't be wearing helmets when we're biking, or that we shouldn't be modifying tests for people who need extra support educationally. But the video on the other side does make a point about failure. Anybody wanna suggest what might be the point made about failure here? Ariel, go.
Maybe that life wasn't everything on a silver platter for them, and that's what ended up like propelling them to do great things.
Okay, the things weren't so simple for them, for us, even for you, I'll say. Okay, I think some of these things haven't really changed. But that by not whitewashing those low points, those skinned knees falling off the bike, those going out and not knowing who you're going to play with because the play date wasn't set up for you, we would just kind of wander out, right, moms, onto the block on a Sunday afternoon. And if somebody was there, you bounced a ball, and it didn't have to be a prearranged social situation and dynamic, right? That there were things that resulted from that were very positive. Zisi, what do you want to say?
I think that it really built the character of that generation. Like right now, like some people just don't deal with failure until later in life because we protect everyone who's young from failure. But really, people need those skills to go forward.
So that, and Zisi just worked with an assumption that failure builds skills. That failure isn't something necessarily to be whitewashed or to be gotten rid of. That when we confront failure, there are some skills that develop. What are some of those skills? What are some of those skills that failure leads to?
Resilience.
What'd you say?
Resilience.
Resilience. Do you want to define that for those who might not be so familiar with that word that is at the crux of our conversation? Yeah.
Resilience is I think it's the idea that you keep pushing even if you're knocked down.
That once you've been knocked down, you get back up again and you keep moving forward. That you keep moving forward. Anybody else want to add a suggestion of a skill that failure actually builds? And if we're suggesting that failure builds skills, then what are we saying about failure? Maybe it's not something to be whitewashed away. Maybe we have the approach of Rav Sham Shneurfall Hirsch to Tanakh and to characters in Tanakh, who says, let's analyze the mistakes and failures of these people. Let's look at how they got up after they were pushed back down. Like Yosef HaTzadik, as Charlie Harari just quoted, right? Who could have said, thrown in the towel and said, I am done. This is over. Yet he pushed on forward in that way. I saw a hand here. Yeah, Michal.
Determination,
right? An ability to push forward when the tide is against you. Zisi made a statement. People will face failures in life. Everything is not going to go exactly the way that you want it to, right? We can't control all circumstances. Sometimes we work hard to want to control all circumstances. At the end of the day, our desire to control all circumstances, to micromanage our lives, to plot out, if I go to this camp and if I make friends with that person, then maybe my roommate will introduce me to their brother and that's who I'll marry and bup, 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 and I've got the whole thing planned out, right? It's actually suggesting that we are in control when in reality, of course, who is in control? Hashem is in control of everything that happens. And interestingly, some of that need or that desire to control things, ironically, and keep all the ducks in order, all of the things in place, in an interesting way, I believe, leads to more anxiety, a little counterintuitive. What would you think? That the more I have everything lined up and in order, the more I know exactly how my day is going to go because I've planned it all. My outfit is laid out, and I know exactly where I'm going to, who I'm going to be sitting next to on the bus, and I planned out, I learned a new thing, honestly, at Shabbaton, that people think not just about who they're sitting with at the Shabbaton, obviously not just who they're rooming with, but when I need to leave shul to go to the bathroom, who's coming with me, right? So I got the whole thing. Yeah, I was late in learning this, but okay. This is obviously a well-known concept. I've got everything mapped out, so I should never, in Charlie's words, also be alone, because that's really scary, right? I got all the bases covered. But that leads to a certain level of anxiety. Why? Because what if I do that when she's not there, right? What if that's the way I thought things were going to happen? I lined up my life and I was sure this was going to happen, but there wasn't enough spaces in the program that I wanted to go to when I don't necessarily get in, right? Then what happens? Then my life actually turns into a very stressful place. And I think that if you watch the video again, there are a lot of nuances to the language that's used here, but the suggestion is made that we're not necessarily better off by everything being so controlled. And again, when it comes to safety, I don't think there's any question about that, right? And when it comes to equality, I don't think there's any question about that. And treating people fairly for what their abilities are, I don't think there's any question about that. But in those other areas of trying to control the situation, well, maybe you would meet somebody you never thought you could be friendly with because you didn't control your social dynamic to such an extent that you were so stuck in your specific ways. So there's a very interesting definition of bitachon that's developed by the Chazon Ish in a famous sefer called Emuna uBitachon. Bitachon, obviously, trust is part of our conversation and discussion for today. And he teaches us something in Parak Bet that is so essentially, it's an essential part of our understanding of what Emuna is all about. You see, sometimes we make the mistake, the Chazon Ish says, to believe that Emuna means that what I want to happen will happen. I truly believe that what I want to happen, I want to get into this particular program, I want this person to like me, I want to get 100 on the test, that Emuna means to trust in Hashem that what I want to happen will actually happen. Says the Chazon Ish, that is a terrible misunderstanding of what Emuna means. Emuna means that I trust that I am not in control, that it's not about what I want to happen, but rather I trust that there are multiple options of what could happen. Could be A, or it could be B. It could be that I'll be here, or I'll be there. It could be she says yes, or she says no. It could be that he says yes, and he says no. And that whatever happens, I trust and I believe that it is for the good. I've pointed out, and I know it's something that Ariella has quoted herself a few times, right? That when we say the phrase gamzu litova, so important to notice that lamed. We don't say gamzu tova. We don't say it's going to be good. And good is my definition of good. I have controls and I have planned out exactly what should happen in my life. But rather, what do we say? I believe, gamzu litova, that whatever happens, option A or option B, happens to be the name of a popular best-selling book on the New York Times bestseller list, option B, written by about a woman whose life turned to option B, a completely secular book. But either one that it is, option A or option B, that I believe that because God is in control, not me lining up my ducks in just the right order, but that will be for the good. Says the Chazon Ish, that is the ultimate definition of what Emuna actually is. This is something which is actually not so easy to always put into action, and not always so easy to put into practice. If you think about it, there are so many places in life where our lack of control, now I'm going to say the opposite of what I just said a minute ago, actually makes us uncomfortable and can leave us very anxious. So we look to control situations as best as possible. If you ever noticed that one of the immediate reactions upon people hearing that somebody, Lo Aleinu, has passed away, is to ask the question, were they sick? Right? It's a very natural reaction that people have. Either they verbalize it or they think it to themselves. Oh, I didn't hear they weren't well, I didn't know. From a psychological and emotional perspective, right, what is that information worth at the moment? Not much, right? You're not recommending a doctor, you're not able to help them. Why do we have a curiosity or an interest to know that piece of information? Because it creates a certain order in our minds, right? If we can understand the order in which things happened, and again, we don't wish that upon anybody, and it doesn't make the situation better, or it doesn't make us happier, but it does make us a little more comfortable. Because I can understand natural order. How old were they, we might ask? Were they not well? Some of these questions allude to the concept that that's the way things go. That's the way things line up. When things happen in life, as Zisi said, and will happen to all of us, where we encounter some kind of failure that we couldn't control, we studied for the test, and we still didn't do well, it's very disconcerting to us. And it's very, very hard for us to recognize that we may have put our hishtadlut into something, our best effort, and I want to be clear, I didn't make this disclaimer to start with. Hishtadlut is obviously in all circumstances, right? Whether it's seeing doctors or studying for a test or anything else that happens in life, a key ingredient in what makes the world go round. There's Hashem's ratzon and there is our effort. Both of those work in tandem. Perhaps a conversation another time, how they work in tandem. But for the purposes of this session, I've done the best that I can in a particular circumstance. And to realize that what might still be true at that moment, even though I've done the best, I got all my references lined up, I called anybody I could call to help me and support my candidacy for something, I studied for the test, I got a tutor, I did whatever I could do to put myself in the best situation possible, and there still might be an option B. Says the Chazon Ish, true emunah is the belief and the understanding that there isn't just one option. That I can't control all outcomes. That I might experience failure. And I use the word failure here, girls, loosely. I don't mean below a 65. I mean that I might not meet my expectations for success in whatever arena this might be, and that could still be Ritzon Hashem, and it could still be something to embrace, and it could still be something that gives me the opportunity to develop skills and parts of myself that if I don't encounter failure, I would not be strong in those areas. That I won't have the social confidence to meet new people because everything is organized for me in that particular way. Two very beautiful concepts that I often think about that demonstrate this. And again, in a longer presentation, we could explore each of these things. But if you want to look at either of these things on your own, they are stunning depictions of this concept. The first is actually in Tehillim, Perek Kuf Lamed Aleph. And in that Perek, B'nai Yisrael are compared to a nursing baby. And like many psukim in Tehillim, very honestly, some of these descriptions kind of go over your head. Okay, it's one more poetic conversation or discussion about our relationship with Hashem, and that relationship is a relationship of a young baby nursing and getting its sustenance from its mother. Hashem provides us with everything. I heard a beautiful explanation from Rabbi Yaakov Friedman in Eretz Yisrael. He has yeshiva in Beitar, Birchas Mordechai it's called. And he explained as following. If you've ever watched a baby nursing, and again, the moms in this room can relate to this a drop more, but if you have younger siblings and ever watched a mother or an aunt or a sister nursing their child, there's a fascinating phenomenon that happens when a baby is nursing. Baruch Hashem, nursing is the ability that Hashem gives us naturally to sustain young children. And that sustenance can happen any place at any time, right? There are all sorts of discussions in politics and in law about legalizing and giving opportunities for women to nurse wherever they want to nurse in that particular way. It's a pretty easy thing to happen. Rabbi Yaakov Friedman says that if you ever noticed, a baby could nurse in the absolutely tranquil setting, sitting on a beach by the seashore, absolutely quiet, and will enjoy nursing from its mother. And a baby could nurse in the middle of a battlefield with things going on all around it. Or when I heard of Yaakov Friedman, I was thinking to myself in the middle of my den, right? With my kids fighting and you know, jumping all over each other. And the baby might disconnect from its mother for a split second upon hearing that noise. But what will immediately happen? It'll go right back to nursing. Why? Because it is so connected to the source. It so trusts and recognizes the arms that are holding that baby, that whatever the circumstances around it, option A or option B, and they can be totally different, it feels secure in that moment. Everybody else in the room or everybody else in the battlefield is scared for their life. But the nursing child trusts its mother in a way that it feels secure no matter what is going on around it. The ideal relationship with Hashem is one where even if the scene around me is not ideal, even if this isn't the beautiful picture of a Sunday afternoon, everyone getting along together, feeling good, etc., I trust my connection to Hashem to sustain me through those circumstances. The second thing is something that the Lubavitcher Rebbe teaches. The Lubavitcher Rebbe, and it's very beautiful for the upcoming holiday of Tu B'Shvat, the Lubavitcher Rebbe teaches about the pasuk in Sefer Devarim, Ki Adam Eitz Hasadeh. That man is a tree. And he points out very simply, that's a really weird language. The pasuk doesn't say man's like a tree, but rather what does the pasuk say? Man is a tree. Now, last time I checked, the Kuzari has a lengthy development about the fact that there are all different types of creations and creatures, and man is above all of them. And we are certainly not like plants and animals. We have bechira, we have the ability to speak, we have so many things that separate us from the other living creatures on earth. Why are you telling me we are a tree? And the Lubavitcher Rebbe, in one of his sichot on the parsha, develops a stunning idea. He says, we are like a tree because we weather a lot of seasons and a lot of storms. And there are times where we shrivel up, we lose our beauty, we lose our leaves, and they aren't the stunning times of year like this time of year for the tree. But the tree is, to use Ariella's word, resilient. The tree has the ability to bounce back. The tree says that this isn't what I designed. This isn't what I wished for. This isn't when I'm at my best and my brightest. But I know that when I'm at my lowest, when I'm experiencing failure, and if I understand the science of the way that works, too much to go into right now, that it's actually the failing moments that are going to lead to my ultimate blossoming in the spring. But trees that blossom have deep roots. And like the nursing child that is connected to its mother, the blossoming tree will only blossom when it's connected to its roots, when it's connected ultimately to the Ribono Shel Olam. There is an amazing book that if you have the opportunity to learn together enough, you will hear me quote many, many times. It's called, the name of the book is called Mindsets, also a completely secular book by Carol Dweck. Just show of hands among the students. How many of you ever heard about it? Oh boy, we've got to spend more time together. Okay. Carol Dweck is a social scientist who became very, very famous for a study that she did, believe it or not, about tracking success in students in school. She wanted to know what were the key ingredients to students being successful in school, and then she studied them many years later in life as well. And you would think that it was natural intelligence, ability, talent, motivation, many, many things. And she came to the conclusion that the abilities for people to succeed basically breaks down into two types of mindsets, a fixed mindset and a growth mindset. And you could Google these words, ladies. There is tons about them, tons of graphic charts like this that explain it very clearly, and many, many articles about them as well. But it's a fascinating conversation that relates directly to Emuna. She says there are people who are incredibly successful in life, and they are people who have a fixed mindset. It's clear to them. I'm great in math. I'm totally not musically talented. It's clear to them that I am a social person, or it's clear to them that they are a very shy person in that way. And there are people who have a growth mindset who says, I know who I am now, I actually have no idea what I could be tomorrow. Perhaps I could be more musical than I am. Perhaps I could grow to be more social and less shy. I'm not fixed in my perceptions of myself. Forget about what anybody else thinks about you, but in your own perceptions. If you follow the chain of characteristics that she studied, were true of people with a fixed and growth mindset, you will see some very stark challenges. You see, the fixed mindset person avoids challenges. Why, girls? Because what do they know? What's fixed in their mind? If it's challenging, then what does that mean? I can't do it, right? I know that, right? I'm not coordinated in that way, right? I'm not a math student. I'm not going to try to challenge myself in Ivrit or in any other course. And therefore, since I already know I can't do it, what am I going to do? I'm going to give up pretty easily. That's just not my thing. You put a Sudoku in front of me, and I don't do Sudokus. I'm done. What else is true? Why should I even try? Because after all, what's true? I'm not good at that in any way. And if somebody wants to try to help me, give me a little trick about how I could be better, what's my initial reaction? I shut down. Don't give me any constructive criticism. Why? Because it's fixed. I'm just not good at that in that way. And I also see somebody who's really good at something, and what do I say? Makes me feel really small. Because after all, what do I know about myself? I'm not good in that area, right? Fascinatingly, people with fixed mindsets can be excellent students. They can be amazingly popular, right? But what's true about their mindset? This is the key. It's fixed. They know what they're good at, and they know what they're not good at. The people with the growth mindset, listen to what they say about themselves. They are people who say, I don't need to look smart. I don't mind being the person who is the slowest to catch on in the class. I like challenges, because what might be true, it may be challenging, but I could learn something. You see, I don't mind going out into the street and seeing who's out there to be friendly with or to play ball with. It could be they'll tell me that I can't be included in the game, but that's okay, because maybe I'll meet somebody new. And therefore, what's true? They persist in the face of setbacks. Today there was nobody for me to play with, but I'll go back out tomorrow. I don't have to have a prearranged, controlled social setting or social dynamic, because after all, what's true, girls? I am able to accept there's an option A and option B. Today there may be nobody to play with, but that might be something that was meant to be for me today. I trust the mother who I nurse from, the roots that I am rooted to for my growth and development, and the fact that I failed today socially says nothing about what might be tomorrow, because I have that growth mindset. Effort is something that I deeply value, because the harder I try at something, option A is I'll succeed. What's option B with effort? I may fail. But I see that effort as something that's worth it for the possibility that I may learn something new about myself. It's not about results for the growth mindset person. But fascinatingly, what did Carol Dweck studies prove? That in the long term, the person with the growth mindset, the person who said, let me try something different, let me take a risk, everything doesn't have to be so clearly mapped out in my life, ultimately were the people who were most successful in life. You see, because look what it says at the bottom. On the left-hand side, the fixed mindset person plateaus early and achieves less than their full potential. The growth mindset person is like the little engine that could, chugging up that mountain. Whatever mountain it is in your life, as Isi said, we all have mountains in some area or the other. And that person says, I can keep reaching ever higher. There may be failures, but those failures are part of my process of moving forward and becoming somebody who is more persistent. In my mind, to use Carol Dweck's paradigm, the growth mindset person is able to move forward because of emunah. What do I mean by that? Carol Dweck doesn't know the word emunah. But they're able to say, according to the Chazon Ish's definition, there are two options. It's not that I failed and life's over, pull the head covers over my head, I'm embarrassed and I can't be seen. It's I tried, and either I was going to be successful in option A, or I might have failed in option B. But that failure is designed by the Ribono Shel Olam. It's not for me to control. And that failure, just like the success is an opportunity, as was said, the failure is an opportunity as well. It makes people more resilient. It helps them face future challenges. It might mean that they meet new people that they could never have designed or controlled to be part of that in their own lives. It might be that they explore new areas of academic ability or new talents, or they try to pick up a new hobby when they're in high school. Then they may feel like a fool because they're third graders that can play the violin better than they can. But it doesn't matter, because there's an option here to be successful, and there's a legit option that I might fail. But to the growth mindset, failure doesn't scare me. Failure is something that I embrace. Failure is seen as an opportunity for growth, where I can get constructive feedback, where I can sit perhaps with a teacher or a mentor or a friend, how can I do this better next time? And I will be more successful based on that feedback that I got. When we look at two specific characters, and with this I'll close, in Tanakh, there is something very, very striking about this phenomenon. When I think about people, a person in Tanakh that to me represents emuna in the greatest way and is most verbal about it, my mind immediately goes to David HaMelech. Just quoted a pasuk about the nursing baby from Tehillim. He obviously authored Sefer Tehillim, well over 100 prakim about his relationship to Hashem. I guess a bracha that I have for myself and for all of you is that Ad Me'ev Esther Shana, we should be able to write 130 prakim describing our relationship with Hashem, talking about being able to talk about your relationship with Hashem. It's amazing. But what's fascinating is that what we call David Melech Yisrael Chai V'Kayam, he's the ultimate king, he's the one who established monarchy, he's not our first king. Who's our first king?
Shaul.
Shaul HaMelech, though, didn't reign for all that long. How long did Shaul reign for? A whopping 2 years, right? David HaMelech reigned till the end of his life, okay? When you look at the two monarchies, and this is something that you'll have the opportunity to study in school a little bit, I find it absolutely fascinating. David HaMelech is described at the beginning, Shaul HaMelech, excuse me, is picked as the first king. He's the most likely to succeed. He has it all together. He is as pure as a baby, Ben Shana L'Malcho. He never tasted sin. He is a pristine human being. Never really had too many challenges in life. And he lasts 2 years in the position of king because leadership is mighty challenging. And he had never built up those muscles of disappointing other people. So the people wanted to do something, he doesn't know how to disappoint them. He feels like a failure in their eyes, so what does he do? He just gives in to them. And he disappoints Shmuel and he disappoints Hashem, and it's a disaster because he's never experienced failure in his life. His life was squeaky clean. It was a simple, pristine, may I say, controlled existence. He never had a skinned knee falling off a bike. He never hurt himself. He never socially failed in any way. So when the big tests came later in life, he failed miserably. When you look at the introduction to David HaMelech, he is a bundle of conflict. He's described as Admoni im Yafeh Einayim. He's got gorgeous eyes, but he has a rugged appearance. He's aggressive and he's soft. He's a mixed up mess internally. So mixed up that when Shmuel comes to anoint a king from his house, do you know where he is? He's in the backfields. He's nowhere to be found. Could you imagine, girls, if the rabbi of the shul is eating lunch at your house, moms don't say anything, and you're eating the Shabbos lunch at your house, right? And you say, Mom, it's really awkward. I really don't want to be here. I'm going to a friend. What's your mom going to say? Your life, the rabbi's coming. We're staying here. The whole family is going to be on display. Yishai doesn't even want Shmuel to meet David. And when he does, what does Shmuel say? That's it. Because to succeed in life, in leadership, and we're all leaders. We're not all going to be kings. We're not all going to be presidents. But you're going to be leaders of your families. You're going to be leaders in the workplace. You're going to be leaders of your community. You have to have experienced conflict. And you have to be a person of a growth mindset. And that growth mindset is going to be the mindset of I fail, and it fails miserably. But he never blames other people. He takes personal responsibility, unlike Shaul. And he's able to move beyond those failures to be an amazing king who we admire so deeply, but also to be able to express a nuanced relationship with Hashem, because the reason why he's able to push himself forward is his emunah in Hashem, his belief that even when I fail, that's part of God's plan. And God is here to pick me up, and God is here to let me re-blossom like the wilted trees outside. Because I'm rooted with Hashem, and He is ultimately rooting for me. That is the recognition of option B, and that is true.